This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to More or Less, the show which crushingly rejects dodgy statistics while giving a vote of confidence to the good ones. This week, we ask if most of us are really averaging a bottle of wine a day during December. We remember the father of the index fund, who, according to one possibly over-enthusiastic estimate, saved investors a total of $1 trillion. We think that's a bit much, but it's certainly enough to be worth celebrating. But first, this week, the BBC website published a short documentary under the title Intersex Surgeries. Is it right to assign sex to a baby?
Rosie, medicine time.
I hate my
medicine. Rosie was born 6 years ago with ambiguous genitalia. The UN believe as high as 1.7% of the world are born with intersex traits. That's roughly the same as people with red hair.
1.7% of the population sounds a lot. And if you say it's the same as the proportion of redheads, it sounds like an awful lot because, well, thankfully, there are a lot of redheads around. What do these claims really mean? Let's start with the redheads. One of my favourite topics, my wife is one. 1.7% is a credible estimate for the global population of redheads. But their population in the UK, Ireland and North America is rather higher. If you were Chinese and heard that being intersex was as common as being a redhead, you'd think it was rare. If you were from Scotland, you'd reach a very different conclusion. So we don't think as common as redheads really helps people understand. Now, about this idea that 1.7% of the world has intersex characteristics, we asked the BBC's global gender and identity correspondent, Megha Mohan, about it. She's the presenter of the documentary in question. She pointed us to the UN's Free and Equal website, which says that the figure could be as high as 1.7%, or if you dig a bit further, it also says it could be as low as 0.05%. That's a big difference, the difference between one person in 60 and one person in 2000. A bit more Googling, and we traced the origin of the 1.7% figure to a book written by the American biology professor Anne Faust Sterling called Sexing the Body, Gender Politics and the Construction of Sexuality. The book argues against seeing the world in the terms of two sexes, male and female. And part of the argument is based on the fact that intersex conditions are not uncommon. But there's a vast range of experiences gathered together under that label. The BBC documentary did mention that intersex is a broad umbrella term, but in fact focuses on situations where surgery is being debated. For example, someone who appears female on the outside but inside has testes rather than ovaries, or someone whose external genitals seem ambiguous. These situations are rare. One expert reckoned that they make up only 1 in 100 of the people sometimes put in this 1.7% group. So not 1.7%, but 0.017%. What about the other 99 in 100? Well, they have other conditions, by far the most common of which is late-onset or non-classic congenital adrenal hyperplasia. This is a hormonal condition, so we contacted a loyal listener who also happens to be a consultant endocrinologist, Dr. Bernard Koo of the Royal Free Hospital in London. We asked him about the condition and its symptoms.
What happens here is that these patients have got a genetic change in some of the enzymes that process hormones in the adrenal gland. And the end result is that they make a slight excessive amount of male hormones, particularly testosterone.
So these would be women with high levels of testosterone?
Correct.
And also men? Or?
Yes.
So, and would they be in the 1.7% or?
Yes. So you have to recognise that men also may have this slight defect in the way that they make hormones, and they make slightly more testosterone from the adrenal glands than one would expect. But we never really see these male patients because having a little bit more testosterone in a man is unremarkable and doesn't really affect their life. So the reason why we see this condition mostly in women is because the slight excess of testosterone interferes with various things in their life. So they have a tendency to grow more hair around their face, lose hair from the top of their head. They have irregular periods and may have difficulty in conceiving children.
If you don't count late-onset congenital adrenal hyperplasia as an intersex diagnosis, the proportion of people who might be described as having intersex conditions would drop to 0.2%, 1 in 500. But there are other sex chromosome variations in that figure which Dr. Koo also thinks aren't helpfully given the label of intersex conditions. In fact, Dr. Koo told us that the medical profession simply doesn't use the term intersex. It's just too vague. There are too many different kinds of situation it's attempting to describe.
In my practice, what I prefer to do is to be fairly specific about what the condition is. And this leads to treatment or management which suits the patient and suits the patient's preferences, as opposed to trying to bung everybody together under one big umbrella. Some of the people under this umbrella, they wouldn't necessarily consider themselves intersex as such.
The phrase disorders of sexual differentiation, or DSD, is the medical term of art, apparently. But because Dr. Koo and his family are all loyal listeners, he kindly stuck his neck out and gave us his best guess.
I think there are a lot of people in the community who live with something that we fairly describe as intersex. They don't necessarily present themselves to the medical profession, and therefore the estimates are very truly difficult to get at. I personally feel that there are far more people living out in the community than we necessarily recognize in the medical community, but certainly not as high as 17 in 1,000, which has been suggested by some authorities. I think personally it would be nearer 1 in 1,000.
1 in 1,000. So 0.1% rather than 1.7%.
Correct.
Dr. Bernard Koo, there's a lesson in that. If you're a loyal listener and you study hard, you too could become a consultant. Eagle-eyed loyal listeners Tabitha Burrell and Becky Evans have both emailed more or less at bbc.co.uk to query a post that popped up in their Facebook news feeds in the past week.
Can you imagine working for a company that only has a little more than 635 employees, but has the following employee statistics? 29 have been accused of spouse abuse, 7 have been arrested for fraud, 9 have been accused of writing bad checks, 17 have directly or indirectly bankrupted at least 2 businesses, 3 have done time for assault, 71 cannot get a credit card due to bad credit, 14 have been arrested on drug-related charges, 8 have been arrested for shoplifting, 21 are currently defendants in lawsuits, 84 have been arrested for drink driving in the last year, and collectively this year alone have cost the British taxpayer £92,993,748 in expenses. Which organisation is this? You guessed it. It's the House of Commons.
Unbelievable.
Literally.
Oh, Ruth Alexander's here. Hello, Ruth. You've been looking into this.
I have. The first clue that something here wasn't right was that there aren't 635 members of Parliament. There are 650.
Good spot.
Thank you. The next clue was that when I searched for this post on Facebook, I was pointed to an almost identical claim posted online about 10 years ago, where you are asked to imagine working for a company with a little over 500 employees that had exactly the same number of ne'er-do-wells and turned out to be referring to Capitol Hill, the seat of the United States government.
So all the statistics supposedly about MPs here in the UK, they're actually about American politicians, and all these claims were made a decade ago?
Actually, 20 years ago. Because it didn't take me long to find the original source of the statistics, an online article written in 1999.
Online and yet last century, so retro.
I know. The claims first appeared in a series of reports by a political news website called Capitol Hill Blue. Now, the series consisted of articles about four named individuals, and the final piece detailed these statistics as a kind of a summary of the wider research they said they'd done into the conduct of members of Congress, past and present, over the past 7 years. But it wasn't long before journalists were trying to fact-check the claims, asking for the evidence, for names and so on, none of which they got. Eventually, Capitol Hill Blue published another article written by the website's founder, Doug Thompson, entitled America's Criminal Class, We Got Some of It Wrong. And in it, he claimed their research had found Congress to be made up of a collection of rogues, con artists, scofflaws and bad check artists. However, he went on to say, they were unable to verify the wider claims and had had to take down the list, blaming an intern who'd apparently made too many shortcuts.
Always blame the intern. I love the line, we got some of it wrong. Next time I have to publish a correction, I got some of it wrong. That's what I'm going to do. So just to summarise then, these claims weren't even true of congressmen and women 20 years ago, and they're certainly not true of today's MPs in the UK.
Exactly.
Right. Thank you, Ruth. Well, the fact-checking organisation Full Fact has just announced a partnership with Facebook where they'll be testing the truths of posts like this that get passed around from newsfeed to newsfeed. I invited Full Fact director Will Moy into the studio and I asked him, is this the sort of nugget of fool's gold that Full Fact might be looking at in future?
Well, it's the kind of thing that Full Fact always might have looked at. It's glorious. It's instantly grabbed your attention. It's something that people will want to know whether it's true or not. It turns out that it's not. And it's about an important topic. Can we trust our politicians or not? And it's not the whole answer to whether we can trust our politicians or not, but it's certainly important if they all turn out to be crooks who are writing bad checks. So yes, it's up our street.
This is the kind of thing that you might have fact-checked anyway. So what changes because you're teaming up with Facebook or partnering with Facebook? What's different there?
In the world before this partnership, the biggest leverage we had to actually make sure our fact-checking made a difference was ringing people up and asking them to correct the record about mistakes they've made and actually trying to stop that misinformation at source, whether that's the Prime Minister or a newspaper or a website or whatever, and then spotting the patterns in that misinformation and trying to tackle it. So that might be things like talking to the Office for National Statistics to help them communicate more clearly the points they're making to stop people misunderstanding them. And those kind of what you might call supply side interventions if you're an economist. Now we can do something quite different, which is you're on your Facebook feed, you're looking at something, you're in that moment of making the choice about whether to share it, and a box pops up and says, by the way, there's a fact check of this. Do you want to read this before you share it? You don't have to read it. You can ignore it. You can read it and ignore it anyway. It's entirely up to you what you share, but we're getting information to people at the point where they make that choice about whether to help something go viral or not.
And how is that going to look from the point of view of Full Fact? Are Facebook going to be sending stuff to you, or how does it work?
Sort of, yeah. So the other side of what's new for us is getting a bit of insight into what's going on Facebook. We're not seeing anybody's private information, but in terms of posts that are being shared publicly, if Facebook thinks they might potentially be false, then they go into a queue that Full Fact's fact checkers are seeing to get a sense of what are the risks going on in Facebook. And from that, or from our own research, we can pick things that we can fact check. And that queue actually starts with individual Facebook users. So on every Facebook post, there are three dots in the top right corner. You can click that, you can click report post. And one of the options there is false news. And that's one of the signals that might lead us ultimately to be fact checking something and sharing that fact check with Facebook users.
I recently wrote a piece about fake news for the Financial Times, and people emailed me and said, Facebook just shouldn't be allowed to show this stuff. They shouldn't be allowed to circulate things that aren't true. What's your take on that response?
I don't want Facebook deciding that. And I'm not sure that I want anyone else deciding that either. We need to be free to say what we want to each other. And Facebook is the place where you share your cat videos with your friends, you share your holiday plans with your friends, and sometimes you share your political opinions with your friends. You don't want somebody, far less a computer program, telling you that's not okay and you can't say that. So these things are about giving people better choices and more informed choices, not taking choices away from them. And I think that's very important.
Are there any circumstances where you would say, look, this should just be taken down?
Well, I think, again, that that's a choice that has to be made through open, democratic, transparent processes. It's something that absolutely our politicians need to be debating in a much wider context than any one internet company, because we're going to have new companies and new products popping up all the time over the next 5, 10 and more years. So I think that's a really important debate. I don't think it's for full fact to answer. We have quite strict rules on not answering public policy questions generally. And actually the line on where should government set a rule that you can't say certain things is one of the most important questions we're going to keep asking and having to find answers to as the internet develops. And it goes beyond accurate and inaccurate into hate speech and all the rest of it.
And how important do you think fact-checking content on Facebook is, both in terms of full facts overall funding? I mean, maybe you're just going to end up being an appendage of Facebook, and also in terms of the public interest. I mean, how much does social media matter relative to, for example, statements in Parliament or stuff circulating on email or TV or newspaper reporting?
So I am much more concerned about the people running the country and making decisions about our lives being wrong than I am about someone on the internet being wrong. That said, we know that the internet is an ever-increasing source of information for people. About a third of people use Facebook for news. So it is an important platform. And that, of course, is more true of young people. So we know what direction news consumption is going in. It's going online. And we have to be thinking about these issues now before that shift has completely happened, so that we're ready to adapt to the new world. Absolutely, the most important people to check are the people with power. But the online platforms are where power is flowing to, and we need to understand that power and its consequences and how to manage it. And in that sense, that's where the funding from Facebook comes in. We need to make sure that full fact remains independent enough that we can walk away from this at any point if we felt uncomfortable continuing with it. I hope that actually it will be a long-term thing and we will demonstrate continued improvement and we will demonstrate how it's changing with the lessons we learn. But I want to make sure that full fact can walk away at any point.
Will Moy, director of Full Fact, coming to a newsfeed near you. As always, please send your questions and your comments to More or Less at bbc.co.uk. John Bogle, or Jack as he was often known, the creator of the world's first index mutual fund, has died at the age of 89. $10 trillion are now invested in funds like the one he pioneered. But what is an index fund? Well, in my opinion, it's one of the 50 things that made the modern economy, which is why I devoted an episode of my other BBC series to it. With your permission, or indeed even without your permission, I present here an edited version of that episode. Here's a question. What's the best financial investment in the world? If anyone knows the answer, it's Warren Buffett. Buffett is the world's richest investor and one of the world's richest people, full stop. He's worth tens of billions of dollars accumulated over decades of savvy investments. And Warren Buffett's advice? It's in a letter he wrote to his wife, advising her how to invest after he dies. And it's been published online for anyone to read. Those instructions: pick the most mediocre investment you can imagine. Put almost everything into a very low-cost S&P 500 index fund. Yes, an index fund. The idea of an index fund is to be mediocre by definition, to passively track the market as a whole by buying a little of everything, rather than trying to beat the market with clever stock picks. The kind of clever stock picks that Warren Buffett himself has been making for more than half a century. Index funds now seem completely natural, part of the very language of investing. But as recently as 1976, they didn't exist. In the autumn of 1974, the world's most famous economist, Paul Samuelson, Nobel laureate and once advisor to President Kennedy, fired off what he called a challenge to the investment industry. Samuelson had provided a theoretical demonstration of the most important idea in financial economics, often called the efficient markets hypothesis. And that idea had a simple practical corollary. It's almost impossible to beat the stock market. What's more, the data suggested that indeed professional investors rarely did. They just charged high fees for trying. Samuelson laid out his thinking in an article called Challenge to Judgment, which said that most professional investors should quit and do something useful instead, like plumbing. And Samuelson went further. He said that since professional investors didn't seem to be able to beat the market, somebody should set up an index fund, a way for ordinary people to invest in the performance of the stock market as a whole without paying a fortune in fees for fancy professional fund managers to try and fail to be clever. At this point, something interesting happened. A practical businessman actually paid attention to what an academic economist had written. John Bogle had just founded a company called Vanguard, whose mission was to provide simple mutual funds for ordinary investors. No fuss, no fancy stuff, low fees. And what could be simpler and cheaper than an index fund, as recommended by the world's most respected economist? And so Bogle decided he was going to make Paul Samuelson's wish come true. He set up the world's first index fund and waited for investors to rush in. They didn't. When Bogle launched the first index investment trust in August 1976, it flopped. Investors weren't interested in a fund that was guaranteed to be mediocre. Financial professionals hated the idea. Some even said it was un-American. It was certainly a slap in their faces. Bogle was effectively saying, "Don't pay these guys to pick stocks because they can't do better than random chance. Neither can I, but at least I charge less." People called Vanguard's index fund Bogle's folly. But Bogle kept the faith. And slowly, people started to catch on. Active funds are expensive after all. They often trade a lot, buying and selling stocks in search of bargains. They pay analysts handsomely to fly around meeting company directors. The annual fees might sound modest, just a percent or two, but they soon mount up. Eventually, fees can eat away a quarter or more of a typical fund. Now, if the analysts consistently outperform the market, that's money well spent. But Samuelson showed that, in the long run, most don't. The super cheap index funds looked, over time, to be a perfectly credible alternative to active funds, without all the costs. So, slowly and surely, Bogle's funds grew and spawned more and more imitators, each one passively tracking some broad financial benchmark or other, each one tapping into Paul Samuelson's basic insight that if the market's working well, you might as well sit back and go with the flow. Forty years after Bogle launched his index fund, fully 40% of US stock market funds are passive trackers rather than active stock pickers. You might say that the remaining 60% are clinging to hope over experience. Samuelson himself, understandably, thought that the index fund had changed the world for the better. It's already saved ordinary investors literally hundreds of billions of dollars. That's a big deal. For many, it will be the difference between scrimping and saving or relative comfort in old age. In a speech in 2005, when Samuelson himself was 90 years old, he gave Bogle the credit. He said, "I rank this Bogle invention, along with the invention of the wheel, the alphabet, Gutenberg printing, and wine and cheese. A mutual fund that never made Bogle rich, but elevated the long-term returns of the mutual fund owners. Something new under the sun." That episode was originally broadcast before Jack Bogle's death. If you'd like to hear any of the other editions of 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy, or indeed catch the beginning of the second season in just a few weeks, you can subscribe to the 50 Things podcast feed. Meanwhile, you are listening to More or Less. Christmas has been and gone. According to my calculations, Father Christmas quaffed about 20 million glasses of sherry, whiskey or port in the UK alone. And he's not the only one who may be feeling he's overindulged. Beady-eyed listener Alice in Maidenhead was astonished to read in The Guardian.
The average Briton drinks 67 units of alcohol a week.
Can the average Briton really be drinking almost 10 units a day for the whole of December?
Alice asked, and it's a good question, because that's a lot. That's five times the recommended limit, or about a bottle of wine a night. Now, some people no doubt do drink this much and more, but if it's supposed to be the national average, it's quite a total. Even The Guardian seems to doubt the figure. It went up on the website, then it came down. Then it returned with a footnote saying they'd amended the piece to provide further estimates of alcohol consumption over the festive period. The plot thickens. Our chief alcohol reporter, Charlotte MacDonald, would normally be on the case, but she's sleeping Christmas off. So our junior alcohol reporter is here instead. Bethan Head. Hello, Bethan.
Yes, so Alice did a bit of the work for us by clicking the link in the Guardian article. It took her to the Mirror, where she found the 67 units of alcohol a week figure, but with no source. We asked the Mirror for their source, and they told us the Sunday Mirror. The Sunday Mirror, in turn, got it from an independent article published in 2006. That's a while ago, the days when Tony Blair was Prime Minister, so it's hardly the latest thinking on the topic. In any case, that 13-year-old article didn't actually use the figure in question. Instead, it reported over the 12 days of Christmas, the average Briton will get through the equivalent of 137 units of alcohol.
What does that mean, the equivalent of 137 units of alcohol? I mean, a unit of alcohol is a unit of alcohol.
That's really the least of our worries, Tim. The journalist of that Mirror piece told me they'd just halved this 137 figure to get 67 units.
That's not how arithmetic works.
I know, and I brought this up with the journalist. She admitted to me that she'd got her maths wrong. 67 isn't half of 137, and a week isn't half of 12 days. She should have said 80 units a week, assuming the original figure in The Independent was correct.
Which I rather doubt, especially since five of the 12 days of Christmas are in January, when many people cut back. I mean, are we really drinking five times the... Actually, with the correct maths, it's more like six times our recommended weekly limit at Christmas?
It seems unlikely. Numbers from Public Health England show that almost three quarters of drinkers average 14 units or fewer a week. It's a similar story in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. This is self-reported, so most experts think people actually drink a bit more than they admit. But still, to get to 67 or even 80 at Christmas would be quite a bender.
Do we have any idea of how drinking habits change in December? I mean, I would imagine a lot of people drink a bit more. I'm thinking myself, on 25th of December, I had a pretty stiff drink at Tuesday lunchtime. I have to say that is not my usual habit. So do we know about how much more we drink at Christmas?
Well, there's no way of breaking down the self-reported alcohol surveys into monthly averages. So I've been looking at alcohol sales. The latest figures we have are from December 2017, where we bought £1.4 billion worth of alcohol. That's almost 50% more than in other months of the year. But this doesn't give us the full picture. Some people might dust off old bottles of wine or spirits from the cupboard. And I got five bottles of gin for Christmas, and I certainly didn't drink all of those. Most of them are still unopened.
Most of them, eh? And the other thing, I suppose, is what we're measuring there with retail sales might be expensive alcohol rather than more alcohol. Anyway, if retail sales only give us an imperfect picture, is there anyone who's actually tried to estimate the extent of Christmas drinking?
Professor Mark Bellis has. He's from the University of Bangor, and he's conducted surveys in which people are asked what they're drinking at different times of the year, and in particular, on special occasions, including Christmas Day and New Year's Eve. Professor Bellis found that some groups of drinkers admitted to drinking an extra 5 units in a week where there was a special occasion, such as Christmas. The key word there is admitted, because he thinks we probably drink a bit more than that.
Yes, although while Christmas might be a special occasion, December itself I mean, it can't all be special. I don't think the average British person is partying on every single day in December, which is what I think we need to assume. And even if we think Mark Bellis's survey respondents were being very shy about their drinking habits, so let's say people actually drink double the official estimate of 14 units weekly on average, even then we're nowhere near the independence figure of 80 units on average per week during the 12 days of Christmas, or the Guardian or the Mirror's number of 67 units a week during the whole of December. Well, Bethan, thank you very much. That's all we have time for. Please keep your questions and your comments coming in to moreorless@bbc.co.uk. Until next week, goodbye. More or Less was presented by me, Tim Harford. Our team was Bethan Head, Ben Crichton and Lizzie McNeil. The producer was Ruth Alexander. The editor, Richard Varden. And James Beard was doing fabulous things with all the knobs in the studio.
Hello, I'm Tez Ilias, and I'm here to tell you about my podcast, Tez Talks. It'll make you laugh, cry, and even question the cultural choices you have historically made. You can subscribe to Tez Talks on BBC Sounds.